veil to hide Shay. In his carelessness, he had never thought what that role might cost her. "I promised my sister I would treat Tommen as she treated Alayaya," he remembered aloud. He felt as though he might retch. "How can I scourge an 8-year-old boy? But if I don't, Cersei wins." "You don't have Tommen," Bronn said bluntly. "Once she learned the Iron Hand was dead, the Queen sent the Kettleblacks after him, and no one at Rosby had the balls to say them nay." Another blow. Yet a relief as well, he must admit it. He was fond of Tommen. "The Kettleblacks were supposed to be ours," he reminded Bronn, with more than a touch of irritation. "They were, so long as I could give them 2 of your pennies for every one they had from the Queen. But now she's raised the stakes. Osney and Offrey were made knights after the battle, same as me. Gods know what for. No one saw them do any fighting." "My hirelings betray me. My friends are scourged and shamed, and I lie here, rotting," Tyrion thought. "I thought I won the bloody battle. Is this what triumph tastes like? Is it true that Stannis was put to rout by Renly's ghost?" Bronn smiled thinly. From the winch towers, all we saw was banners in the mud and men throwing down their spears to run. But there's hundreds in the pot shops and brothels who'll tell you as how they saw Lord Renly kill this one or that one. Most of Stannis' host had been Renly's to start, and they went right back over at the sight of him in that shiny green armour. After all his planning, after the sortie and the bridge of ships, after getting his face slashed in two, Tyrion had been eclipsed by a dead man. If indeed Renly is dead, something else he would need to look into. How did Stannis escape? His Lysenes kept their galleys out in the bay beyond your chain. When the battle turned bad, they put in along the bay shore and took off as many as they could. Men were killing each other to get aboard, toward the end. What of Robb Stark? What has he been doing? There's some of his wolves burning their way down toward Duskendale. Your father's sending this Lord Tarly to sort them out. I'd half a mind to join him. It said he's a good soldier and open-handed with the plunder. The thought of losing Bronn was the final straw. No, your place is here. You're the captain of the Hand's Guard. You're not the Hand, Bronn reminded him sharply. Your father is, and he's got his own bloody guard. What happened to all the men you hired for me? Some died at the Winch Towers. That uncle of yours, Sir Kevin, he paid the rest of us and tossed us out. How good of him, Tyrion said acidly. Does that mean you've lost your taste for gold? Not bloody likely. Good, said Tyrion, because as it happens, I still have need of you. What do you know of Sir Mandon Moore? Bronn laughed. I know he's bloody well drowned. I owe him a great debt, but how to pay it? He touched his face, feeling the scar. I know precious little of the man, if truth be told. He had eyes like a fish, and he wore a white cloak. What else do you need to know? Everything, said Tyrion, for a start. What he wanted was proof that Sir Mandon had been Cersei's, but he dare not say so aloud. In the Red Keep, a man did best to hold his tongue. There were rats in the walls and little birds who talked too much, and spiders. Help me up, he said, struggling with the bedclothes. It's time I paid a call on my father, and past time I let myself be seen again. Such a pretty sight, mocked Bronn. What's half a nose on a face like mine? But speaking of pretty, is Margaery Tyrell in King's Landing yet? No, she's coming, though, and the city's mad with love for her. The Tyrells have been carting food up from Highgarden and giving it away in her name. Hundreds of wains every day. There's thousands of Tyrell men swaggering about with little golden roses sewn on their doublets, and not a one is buying his own wine. Wife, widow, or whore, the women are all giving up their virtue to every peach-fuzz boy with a gold rose in his tit. They spit on me and buy drinks for the Tyrells. Tyrion slid from the bed to the floor. His legs turned wobbly beneath him. The room spun, and he had to grasp Bronn's arm to keep from pitching headlong into the rushes. "Pod!" he shouted. "Podrick Payne! Where in seven hells are you?" Payne gnawed at him like a toothless dog. Tyrion hated weakness, especially his own. It shamed him, and shame made him angry. "Pod, get in here!" The boy came running. When he saw Tyrion standing and clutching Bronn's arm, he gaped at them.
"My lord, you stood. Is that... Do you need wine? Dream wine? Shall I get the maester? He said you must stay abed, I mean."
"I have stayed abed too long. Bring me some clean garb."
"Garb?"
How the boy could be so clear-headed and resourceful in battle, and so confused at all other times, Tyrion could never comprehend.
"Clothing," he repeated. "Tunic, doublet, breeches, hose, for me to dress in, so I can leave this bloody cell."
It took all three of them to clothe him. Hideous though his face might be, the worst of his wounds was the one at the juncture of shoulder and arm, where his own mail had been driven back into his armpit by an arrow. Pus and blood still seeped from the discoloured flesh whenever Maester Franken changed his dressing, and any movement sent a stab of agony through him. In the end, Tyrion settled for a pair of breeches and an oversized bedrobe that hung loosely about his shoulders. Bronn yanked his boots onto his feet, while Pod went in search of a stick for him to lean on. He drank a cup of dream wine to fortify himself. The wine was sweetened with honey, with just enough of the puppy to make his wounds bearable for a time. Even so, he was dizzy by the time he turned the latch, and the descent down the twisting stone steps made his legs tremble. He walked with a stick in one hand and the other on Pod's shoulder. A serving girl was coming up as they were going down. She stared at them with wide white eyes, as though she were looking at a ghost. "The dwarf has risen from the dead," Tyrion thought.
"And look, he's uglier than ever. Run, tell your friends."
Maegar's Holdfast was the strongest place in the Red Keep, a castle within the castle, surrounded by a deep dry moat lined with spikes. The drawbridge was up for the night when they reached the door. Sir Meron Trant stood before it in his pale armour and white cloak.
"Lower the bridge," Tyrion commanded him. "The Queen's orders are to raise the bridge at night."
Sir Meron had always been Cersei's creature.
"The Queen's asleep, and I have business with my father."
There was magic in the name of Lord Tywin Lannister. Grumlin, Sir Meron Trant, gave the command, and the drawbridge was lowered. A second Kingsguard knight stood sentry across the moat. Sir Osmond Kettleblack managed to smile when he saw Tyrion waddling towards him.
"Feeling stronger, my lord?"
"Much. When's the next battle? I can scarcely wait."
When Pod and he reached the Serpentine Steps, however, Tyrion could only gape at them in dismay.
"I will never climb those by myself," he confessed to himself.
Swallowing his dignity, he asked Bronn to carry him, hoping against hope that at this hour there would be no one to see and smile, no one to tell the tale of the dwarf being carried up the steps like a babe in arms. The outer ward was crowded with tents and pavilions, dozens of them.
"Tyrell men,"
Podrick Payne explained as they threaded their way through a maze of silk and canvas.
"Lord Rowan's too, and Lord Redwine's. There wasn't room enough for all. In the castle, I mean. Some took rooms in the city, in inns and all. They're here for the wedding, the king's wedding, King Joffrey's. Will you be strong enough to attend, my lord?"
"Ravening weasels could not keep me away."
There was this to be said for weddings over battles, at least. It was less likely that someone would cut off your nose. Lights still burned dimly behind shuttered windows in the Tower of the Hand. The men on the door wore the crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms of his father's household guard. Tyrion knew them both, and they admitted him on sight. though neither could bear to look long at his face, he noted.
Within they came upon Sir Adam Marbrand, descending the turnpike stair in the ornate black breastplate and cloth of gold cloak of an officer in the city watch.
"Oh, my lord," he said, "ha! How good to see you on your feet. I'd heard
rumours of a small grave being dug. Me too. Under the circumstances, it seemed best to get up. I hear you're commander of the city watch. Shall I offer congratulations or condolences?"
"Both, I fear," Sir Adam smiled. "Death and desertion have left me with some 4,400. Only the guards and Littlefinger know how we're going to go on paying wages for so many. But your sister forbids me to dismiss any."
"Still anxious," says she. "The battle's done. The gold cloaks won't help you now."
"Do you come from my father?" he asked.
I fear I did not leave him in the best of moods. Lord Tywin feels 4,400 guardsmen more than sufficient to find one lost squire. But your cousin Tyrek remains missing."
Tyrek was the son of his late uncle Tyget, a boy of 13. He had vanished in the riot, not long after wedding the Lady Ermisonde, a suckling babe who happened to be the last surviving heir of House Hayford, and likely the first bride in the history of the Seven Kingdoms to be widowed before she was weaned.
"I couldn't find him either," confessed Tyrion. "He's feeding worms," said Bronn, with his usual tact. "Ironhand looked for him, and the eunuch rattled a nice fat purse. They had no more luck than we did. Give it up, sir."
Sir Adam gazed at the sellsword with distaste.
"Lord Tywin is stubborn where his blood is concerned. He will have the lad alive or dead, and I mean to oblige him."
He looked back to Tyrion.
"You will find your father in his solar."
"My solar," thought Tyrion. "I believe I know the way."
The way was up more steps, but this time he climbed under his own power, with one hand on Pud's shoulder. Bronn opened the door for him. Lord Tywin Lannister was seated beneath the window, writing by the glow of an oil lamp. He raised his eyes at the sound of the latch.
"Tyrion."
Calmly, he laid his quill aside.
"I'm pleased you remember me, my lord."
Tyrion released his grip on Pod, leaned his weight on the stick, and waddled closer.
"Something is wrong," he knew at once.
"Sir Bronn," Lord Tywin said, "Podrick, perhaps you'd better wait without until we are done."
The look Bronn gave the hand was little less than insolent. Nonetheless, he bowed and withdrew, with Pod on his heels. The heavy door swung shut behind them, and Tyrion Lannister was alone with his father. Even with the windows of the solar shuttered against the night, the chill in the room was palpable.
"What sort of lies has Cersei been telling him?"
The Lord of Castle Rock was as lean as a man 20 years younger, even handsome in his austere way. Stiff blonde whiskers covered his cheeks, framing a stern face, a bald head, a hard mouth. About his throat he wore a chain of golden hands, the fingers of each clasping the wrist of the next.
"That's handsome chain," Tyrion said, "though it looked better on me."
Lord Tywin ignored the sally.
"You had best be seated. Is it wise for you to be out of your sick bed?"
"I am sick of my sick bed."
Tyrion knew how much his father despised weakness. He claimed the nearest chair.
"Such pleasant chambers you have. Would you believe it? While I was dying, someone moved me to a dark little cell in Magor's."
"The Red Keep is overcrowded with wedding guests. Once they depart, we will find you more suitable accommodations."
"I rather like these accommodations. Have you set a date for this great wedding?"
"Joffrey and Margaery shall marry on the first day of the new year, which, as it happens, is also the first day of the new century. The ceremony will herald the dawn of a new era.
"A new Lannister era," thought Tyrion.
"Oh, bother, I fear I made other plans for that day."
"Did you come here just to complain of your bedchamber and make your lame japes? I have important letters to finish."
"Important letters, to be sure. Some battles are won with swords and spears, others with quills and ravens. Spare me these coy reproaches, Tyrion. I visited your sick bed as often as Maester Balabar would allow it, when you seem like to die."
He steepled his fingers under his chin.
"Why did you dismiss Balabar?"
Tyrion shrugged.
"Maester Franken is not so determined to keep me insensate.
Balabar came to the city in Lord Redwine's retinue. A gifted healer, it said. It was kind of Cersei to ask him to look after you. She feared for your life."
"Feared that I might keep it, you mean? Doubtless that's why she's never once left my bedside."
"Don't be impertinent. Cersei has a royal wedding to plan. I'm waging a war, and you have been out of danger for at least a fortnight."
Lord Tywin studied his son's disfigured face, his pale green eyes unflinching.
"Though the wound is ghastly enough, I'll grant you. What madness possessed you?"
"The foe was at the gates with a battering ram. If Jaime had led the sortie, you'd call it valour."
"Jaime would never be so foolish as to remove his helm in battle. I trust you killed the man who caught you."
"Oh, the wretch is dead enough.
Though it had been Podrick Payne who killed Sir Mandon, shoving him into the river to drown beneath the weight of his armour."
"A dead enemy is a joy forever," Tyrion said blithely,
though Sir Mandon was not his true enemy. The man had no reason to want him dead.
"He was only a cat's paw, and I believe I know the cat. She told him to make certain I did not survive the battle."
But without proof, Lord Tywin would never listen to such a charge.
"Why are you here in the city, father?" he asked. "Shouldn't you be off fighting Lord Stannis or Robb Stark or someone? And the sooner the better."
"Until Lord Redwine brings his fleet up, we lack the ships to assail Dragonstone." "It makes no matter. Stannis Baratheon's son set on the Blackwater. As for Stark, the boy is still in the west, but a large force of Northmen under Helmund Tallheart and Robert Glover are descending towards Duskendale. I've sent Lord Tarly to meet them, while Sir Gregor drives up the King's Road to cut off their retreat. Tallheart and Glover will be caught between them with a third of Stark's strength."
"Duskendale?"
There was nothing at Duskendale worth such a risk. Had the young wolf finally blundered?
"It's nothing you need trouble yourself with. Your face is pale as death, and there's blood seeping through your dressings. Say what you want, and take yourself back to bed."
"What I want?"
His throat felt raw and tight. What did he want?
"More than you can ever give me, father. Pod tells me that Littlefinger's been made Lord of Harrenhal."
"An empty title, so long as Roose Bolton holds the castle for Robb Stark. Yet Lord Baelish was desirous of the honour. He did us good service in the matter of the Tyrell marriage. A Lannister pays his debts."
The Tyrell marriage had been Tyrion's notion, in point of fact, but it would seem churlish to try to claim that now.
"That title may not be as empty as you think," he warned. "Littlefinger does nothing without good reason. But be that as it may, you said something about paying debts, I believe."
"And you want your own reward, is that it? Very well. What is it you would have of me? Lands, castle, some office?"
"A little bloody gratitude would make a nice start."
Lord Tywin stared at him, unblinking.
"Mummers and monkeys require applause. So did Ares, for that matter. You did as you were commanded, and I'm sure it was to the best of your ability. No one denies the part you played.
The part I played?
What nostrils Tyrion had left must surely have flared.
I saved your bloody city, it seems to me.
Most people seem to feel that it was my attack on Lord Stannis's flank that turned the tide of battle. Lords Tyrell, Rowan, Redwine, and Tarly fought nobly as well, and I'm told it was your sister Cersei who set the pyromancers to making the wildfire that destroyed the Baratheon fleet.
While all I did was to get my nose hairs trimmed, is that it?
Tyrion could not keep the bitterness out of his voice.
Your chain was a clever stroke and crucial to our victory. Is that what you wanted to hear? I'm told we have you to thank for our Dornish alliance as well. You may be pleased to learn that Myrcella has arrived safely at Sonspear. Sir Aerys Urquhart writes that she has taken a great liking to Princess Arianne, and that Prince Tristane is enchanted with her. I must like giving House Martell a hostage, but I suppose that could not be helped.
We'll have our own hostage, Tyrion said. A council seat was also part of the bargain. Unless Prince Doran brings an army when he comes to claim it, he'll be putting himself in our power.
Would that a council seat were all Martell came to claim,
Lord Tywin said.
You promised him vengeance as well.
I promised him justice.
Call it what you will, it still comes down to blood.
Not an item in short supply, surely. I splashed through lakes of it during the battle.
Tyrion saw no reason not to cut to the heart of the matter.
Or have you grown so fond of Sir Gregor Clegane that you cannot bear to part with him?
Sir Gregor has his uses, as did his brother. Every lord has need of a beast from time to time, a lesson you seem to have learned, judging from Sir Bronn and those clansmen of yours.
Tyrion thought of Timmet's burned eye, Shagger with his axe, Cello with a necklace of dried ears, and Bronn. Bronn most of all.
The woods are full of beasts, he reminded his father. The alleyways as well.
True. Perhaps other dogs would hunt as well. I shall think on it. If there's nothing else...
You have important letters, yes.
Tyrion rose on unsteady legs, closed his eyes for an instant as a wave of dizziness washed over him, and took a shaky step toward the door. Later he would reflect that he should have taken a second, and then a third. Instead, he turned.
What do I want, you ask? I'll tell you what I want. I want what is mine by rights. I want Casterly Rock.
His father's mouth grew hard.
Your brother's birthright.
The Knights of the King's Guard are forbidden to marry, to father children, and to hold land. You know that as well as I. The day Jaime put on that white cloak, he gave up his claim to Casterly Rock, but never once have you acknowledged it. It's past time. I want you to stand up before the realm and proclaim that I am your son and your lawful heir.
Lord Tywin's eyes were a pale green flecked with gold, as luminous as they were merciless.
Casterly Rock,
he declared, in a flat, cold, dead tone, and then,
never.
The word hung between them, huge, sharp, poisoned.
I knew the answer before I asked, Tyrion thought. 18 years since Jaime joined the King's Guard, and I never once raised the issue. I must have known. I must always have known.
Why?
He made himself ask, though he knew he would rue the question.
You ask that? You who killed your mother to come into the world? You are an ill-made, devious, disobedient, spiteful little creature full of envy, lust, and low cunning. Men's laws give you the right to bear my name and display my colours, since I cannot prove that you're not mine. To teach me humility, the gods have condemned me to watch you waddle about wearing that proud lion that was my father's sigil and his father's before him. But neither gods nor men shall ever compel me to let you turn Casterly Rock into your whorehouse.
My whorehouse?
The dawn broke. Tyrion understood all at once where this bile had come from. He ground his teeth together and said,
"Cersei told you about Alaeya."
"Is that her name? I confess I cannot remember the names of all your whores. Who was the one you married as a boy?"
"Tysha,"
he spat out the answer, defiant.
"And that camp follower on the Green Fork?"
"Why do you care?"
he asked, unwilling even to speak Shay's name in his presence.
"I don't, no more than I care if they live or die."
"It was you who had Yaya whipped."
It was not a question.
"Your sister told me of your threats against my grandsons."
Lord Tywin's voice was colder than ice.
"Did she lie?"
Tyrion would not deny it.
"I made threats, yes, to keep Alaeya safe, so the Kettle Blacks would not misuse her."
"To save a whore's virtue, you threatened your own house, your own kin. Is that the way of it?"
"You were the one who taught me that a good threat is often more telling than a blow. Not that Joffrey hasn't tempted me sore a few hundred times. If you're so anxious to whip people, start with him. But Tommen? Why would I arm Tommen? He's a good lad, and my own blood."
"As was your mother."
Lord Tywin rose abruptly to tower over his dwarf son.
"Go back to your bed, Tyrion, and speak to me no more of your rights to Casterly Rock. You shall have your reward, but it shall be one I deem appropriate to your service and station, and make no mistake. This was the last time I will suffer you to bring shame unto House Lannister. You are done with whores. The next one I find in your bed, I'll hang."
Arya. They travelled dawn to dusk, past woods and orchards and neatly tended fields, through small villages, crowded market towns, and stout holdfasts. Come dark, they would make camp and eat by the light of the red sword. The men took turns standing watch. Arya would glimpse firelight flickering through the trees from the camps of other travellers. There seemed to be more camps every night, and more traffic on the King's Road by day. Morn, noon, and night they came, old folks and little children, big men and small ones, barefoot girls, and women with babes at their breasts. Some drove farm wagons, or bumped along in the back of ox carts. More rode, draft horses, ponies, mules, donkeys, anything that would walk or run or roll. One woman led a milk cow with a little girl on its back. Arya saw a smith pushing a wheelbarrow with his tools inside, hammers and tongs, and even an anvil. A little while later, a different man with a different wheelbarrow, only inside this one were two babies in a blanket. Most came on foot, with their goods on their shoulders, and weary, weary looks upon their faces. They walked south, toward the city, toward King's Landing, and only 1 in 100 spared so much as a word for Yoren and his charges, travelling north. She wondered why no one else was going the same way as them. Many of the travellers were armed. Arya saw daggers and dirks, scythes and axes, and here and there a sword. Some had made clubs from tree limbs or carved knobby staffs. They fingered their weapons and gave lingering looks at the wagons as they rolled by. Yet in the end, they let the column pass. 30 was too many, no matter what they had in those wagons.
"Look with your eyes,"
Sirio had said,
"Listen with your ears."
One day, a madwoman began to scream at them from the side of the road.
"Fools! They'll kill you, fools!"
She was scarecrow thin, with hollow eyes and bloody feet. The next morning, a sleek merchant on a grey mare reined up by Yorin, and offered to buy his wagons and everything in them for a quarter of their worth.
"It's war. They'll take what they want. You'll do better selling to me, my friend."
Yorin turned away with a twist of his crooked shoulders and spat. Arya noticed the first grave that same day, a small mound beside the road, dug for a child. A crystal had been set in the soft earth, and Lummi wanted to take it until the bull told him he'd better leave the dead alone. A few leagues farther on, Praed pointed out more graves, a whole row freshly dug. After that, a day hardly passed without one. One time Arya woke in the dark, frightened for no reason she could name. Above, the red sword shared the sky with half a thousand stars. The night seemed oddly quiet to her, though she could hear Yoren's muttered snores, the crackle of the fire, even the muffled stirrings of the donkeys. Yet somehow it felt as though the world were holding its breath, and the silence made her shiver. She went back to sleep, clutching Needle. Come morning, when Praed did not awaken, Arya realized that it had been his coughing she had missed. They dug a grave of their own then, burying the sellsword where he'd slept. Yoren stripped him of his valuables before they threw the dirt on him. One man claimed his boots, another his dagger. His mail shirt and helm were parcelled out. His long sword Yoren handed to the bull.
"Arms like yours, might be, you can learn to use this," he told him.
A boy called Tarba tossed a handful of acorns on top of Praed's body, so an oak might grow to mark his place. That evening they stopped in a village at an ivy-covered inn. Yoren counted the coins in his purse and decided they had enough for a hot meal.
"We'll sleep outside, same as ever, but they've got a bathhouse here. If any of you feels the need, a hot water and a lick of soap."
Arya did not dare, even though she smelled as bad as Yoren by now, all sour and stinky. Some of the creatures living in her clothes had come all the way from Flea Bottom with her. It didn't seem right to drown them. Tarba and Hot Pie and the bull joined the line of men headed for the tubs. Others settled down in front of the bathhouse. The rest crowded into the common room. Yoren even sent Lummi out with tankards for the three in fetters, who had been left chained up in the back of their wagon. Washed and unwashed alike, supped on hot pork pies and baked apples. The innkeeper gave them a round of beer on the house.
"I had a brother took the black years ago. Serving boy, clever, but one day he got seen filching pepper for my lord's table. He liked the taste of it, is all. Just a pinch of pepper, but Sir Malcolm was a hard man. You get pepper on the wall?"
When Yoren shook his head, the man sighed.
"Shame. Link love that pepper."
Arya sipped at her tankard cautiously, between spoonfuls of pie still warm from the oven. Her father sometimes let them have a cup of beer, she remembered. Sansa used to make a face at the taste of it, and say that wine was ever so much finer. But Arya had liked it well enough. It made her sad to think of Sansa and her father. The inn was full of people moving south, and the common room erupted in scorn when Yoren said they were travelling the other way.
"You'll be back soon enough," the innkeeper vowed. "There's no going north. Half the fields are burnt, and what folk are left are walled up inside their holdfasts. One bunch rides off at dawn, and another one shows up by dusk. "That's nothing to us," Yoren insisted stubbornly. "Tully of Lannister makes no matter. The Watch takes no part."
"Lord Tully is my grandfather," Arya thought. It mattered to her. But she chewed her lip and kept quiet, listening.
"It's more than Lannister and Tully," the innkeeper said. "There's wild men down from the Mountains of the Moon. Try telling them you take no part. And the Starks are in it too. The young lords come down, the Dead Hand's son."
Arya sat up straight, straining to hear. Did he mean Rob?
"I heard the boy rides to battle on a wolf," said a yellow-haired man with a tankard in his hand.
"Fool's talk," Yoren spat.
"The man I heard it from, he saw it himself. A wolf big as a horse, he swore."
"Swearing don't make it true, Odd," the innkeeper said. "You keep swearing, you pay what you owe me, and I've yet to see a copper."
The common room erupted in laughter, and the man with the yellow hair turned red.
"It's been a bad year for wolves," volunteered a sallow man in a travel-stained green cloak. "Around the God's Eye, the packs have grown bolder than anyone can remember. Sheep, cows, dogs, makes no difference. They kill as they like, and they got no fear of men. It's worth your life to go into those woods by night."
"Ah, that's more tales, and no more true than the other."
"I heard the same thing from my cousin, and she's not the sort to lie,"
an old woman said.
"She says there's this great pack, hundreds of them, man-killers. The one that leads them is a she-wolf, a bitch from the seventh hell."
A she-wolf? Arya slushed her beer, wondering. Was the God's Eye near the Triton? She wished she had a map. It had been near the Triton that she'd left Nymeria. She hadn't wanted to, but Jory said they had no choice, that if the wolf came back with them, she'd be killed for biting Joffrey, even though he deserved it. They'd had to shout and scream and throw stones, and it wasn't until a few of Arya's stones struck home that the direwolf had finally stopped following them. "She probably wouldn't even know me now," Arya thought, "or if she did, she'd hate me." The man in the green cloak said,
"I heard how this hell bitch walked into village one day, a market day, people everywhere, and she walks in bold as you please and tears a baby from its mother's arms. When the tale reached Lord Mouton, him and his son swore they'd put an end to her. They tracked her to a lair with a pack of wolfhounds and barely escaped with their skins. Not one of those dogs came back. Not one."
"That's just a story," Arya blurted out before she could stop herself. "Wolves don't eat babies."
"And what will you know about it, lad?"
asked the man in the green cloak. Before she could think of an answer, Yoren had her by the arm.
"The boy's green sick on beer. That's all it is."
"No, I'm not. They don't eat babies."
"Outside, boy. And see that you stay there until you learn to shut your mouth when men are talking."
He gave her a stiff shove towards a side door that led back to the stables.
"Go on now. See that the stable boy has watered our horses."
Arya went outside, stiff with fury. "They don't," she muttered, kicking at a rock as she stalked off. It went rolling and fetched up under the wagons. "Boy," a friendly voice called out, "lovely boy." One of the men in irons was talking to her. Wearily, Arya approached the wagon, one hand on Needle's hilt. The prisoner lifted an empty tankard, his chains rattling. A man could use another taste of beer. A man has a thirst, wearing these heavy bracelets. He was the youngest of the three, slender, fine-featured, always smiling. His hair was red on one side and white on the other, all matted and filthy from cage and travel. "A man could use a bath, too," he said, when he saw the way Arya was looking at him. "A boy could make a friend." "I have friends," Arya said.
"None I can see,"
said the one without a nose. He was squat and thick, with huge hands. Black hair covered his arms and legs and chest, even his back. He reminded Arya of a drawing she had once seen in a book, of an ape from the Summer Isles. The hole in his face made it hard to look at him for long. The bald one opened his mouth and hissed like some immense white lizard. When Arya flinched back, startled, he opened his mouth wide and waggled his tongue at her. Only it was more of a stump than a tongue. "Stop that," she blurted. "A man does not choose his companions in the black cells," the handsome one with the red and white hair said. Something about the way he talked reminded her of Syria. It was the same, yet different, too. "These two, they have no courtesy. A man must ask forgiveness. You are called Arry, is that not so?"
"Lumpy head," said the noseless one. "Lumpy head, lumpy face, sick boy. Have a care, Loweth. He'll hit you with his stick."
"A man must be ashamed of the company he keeps, Arry," the handsome one said. "This man has the honour to be Jaqen H'ghar, once of the free city of Loreth. Would that he were home. This man's ill-bred companions in captivity are named Rorg." He waved his tankard at the noseless man. "And Biter." Biter hissed at her again, displaying a mouthful of yellowed teeth filed into points. "A man must have some name. Is that not so? Biter cannot speak, and Biter cannot write. Yet his teeth are very sharp, so a man calls him Biter, and he smiles. Are you charmed?" Arya backed away from the wagon. "No, they can't hurt me," she told herself. "They're all chained up." He turned his tankard upside down. "A man must weep." Rorg, the noseless one, flung his drinking cup at her with a curse. His manacles made him clumsy, yet even so he would have sent the heavy pewter tankard crashing into her head if Arya hadn't leapt aside.
"You get us some beer, pimple, now!"
"You shut your mouth," Arya tried to think what Syrio would have done. She drew her wooden practice sword.
"Come closer," Rorg said. "I'll shove that stick up your bungo and fuck you bloody."
Fear cuts deeper than swords. Arya made herself approach the wagon. Every step was harder than the one before. Fierce as a wolverine, calm as still water. The words sang in her head. Syrio would not have been afraid. She was almost close enough to touch the wheel when Biter lurched to his feet and grabbed for her, his irons clanking and rattling. The manacles brought his hands up short, half a foot from her face. He hissed. She hit him, hard, right between his little eyes. Screaming, Biter reeled back and then threw all his weight against his chains. The link slithered and turned and grew taut, and Arya heard the creak of old dry wood as the great iron rings strained against the floorboards of the wagon. Huge, pale hands groped for her, while veins bulged along Biter's arms. But the buns held, and finally the man collapsed backward. Blood ran from the weeping sores on his cheeks. "A boy has more courage than sense," the one who named himself Jaqen H'ghar observed. Arya edged backwards away from the wagon. When she felt the hand on her shoulder, she whirled, bringing up her stick sword again. But it was only the bull. "What are you doing?" He raised his hands defensively.
"Yawen said none of us should go near those three."
"They don't scare me," Arya said.
"Then you're stupid. They scare me."
The bull's hand fell to the hilt of his sword, and Rorg began to laugh.
"Let's get away from them."
Arya scuffed at the ground with her foot, but she let the bull lead her around to the front of the inn. Rorg's laughter and Biter's hissing followed them. "Want to fight?" she asked the bull. She wanted to hit something. He blinked at her, startled. Strands of thick black hair, still wet from the bathhouse, fell across his deep blue eyes.
"I'd hurt you."
"You would not?"
"You don't know how strong I am."
"You don't know how quick I am."
"You're asking for it, Harry."
He drew Praed's longsword.
"This is cheap steel, but it's a real sword."
Arya unsheathed needle. "This is good steel, so it's realer than yours." The bull shook his head.
"Promise not to cry if I cut you."
"I'll promise if you will." She turned sideways into a water dancer's stance, but the bull did not move. He was looking at something behind her. "What's wrong?"
"Gold cloaks."
His face closed up tight.
It couldn't be, Arya thought.
But when she glanced back, they were riding up the King's Road, six in the black ringmail and gold cloaks of the City Watch. One was an officer. He wore a black enamel breastplate ornamented with four golden discs. They drew up in front of the inn.
"Look with your eyes,"
Sirio's voice seemed to whisper. Her eyes saw white leather under their saddles. The horses had been ridden long and hard. Calm as still water, she took the bull by the arm and drew him back behind a tall flowering hedge.
"What is it?" he asked. "What are you doing? Let go."
"Quiet as a shadow," she whispered, pulling him down.
Some of Yoren's other chargers were sitting in front of the bathhouse, waiting their turn at the tub.
"You men," one of the gold cloak shouted. "You the ones left to take the black?"
"We might be,"
came the cautious answer.
"We'd rather join you boys,"
Olrason said. "We hear it's cold on that wall."
The gold cloak officer dismounted.
"I have a warrant for a certain boy."
Yoren stepped out of the inn, fingering his tangled black beard.
"Who is it wants this boy?"
The other gold cloaks were dismounting to stand beside their horses.
"Why are we hiding?" the bull whispered. "It's me they want,"
Arya whispered back. His ear smelled of soap.
"You be quiet."
"The queen wants him, old man. Not that it's your concern," the officer said, drawing a ribbon from his belt. "Here, Her Grace's seal and warrant."
Behind the hedge, the bull shook his head doubtfully.
"Why would the queen want you, Harry?"
She punched his shoulder.
"Be quiet."
Yoren fingered the warrant ribbon with its blob of golden wax.
"Pretty,"
he spit.
"Thing is, the boy's in the night's watch now. What he done back in the city don't mean piss all."
The queen's not interested in your views, old man, and neither am I," the officer said. "I'll have the boy."
Arya thought about running, but she knew she couldn't get far in her donkey when the gold cloaks had horses, and she was so tired of running. She'd run when Sir Meryn came for her, and again when they killed her father. If she was a real water dancer, she would go out there with Needle and kill all of them, and never run from anyone ever again.
"You'll have no one,"
Yoren said stubbornly.
"There's laws on such things."
The gold cloak drew a short sword.
"Here's your law."
Yoren looked at the blade.
"That's no law, just a sword. Happens I got one too."
The officer smiled.
"Old fool, I have five men with me."
Yoren spat.
"Happens I got 30.
The gold cloak laughed.
"This lot,"
said a big lout with a broken nose.
"Who's first?"
he shouted, showing his steel. Tarba plucked a pitchfork out of a bale of hay.
"I am."
"No, I am," cried Cutjack, the plump stonemason, pulling his hammer off the leather apron he always wore.
"Me?"
Kurtz came up off the ground with his skinning knife in hand.
"Me and him,"
Cuss strung his longbow.
"All of us,"
said Rayson, snatching up the tall hardwood walking staff he carried. Dubber stepped naked out of the bathhouse, with his clothes in a bundle, saw what was happening, and dropped everything but his dagger.
"Is it a fight?" he asked.
"I guess," said Hotpie, scrambling on all fours for a big rock to throw. Arya could not believe what she was seeing. She hated Hotpie. Why would he risk himself for her? The one with the broken nose still thought it was funny. "You girls, put away them rocks and sticks before you get spanked. None of you knows what end of a sword to hold." "I do." Arya wouldn't let them die for her like Syrio. She wouldn't. Shoving through the hedge with needle in hand, she slid into a water dancer's stance. Broken Nose guffawed. The officer looked her up and down. "Put the blade away, little girl. No one wants to hurt you." "I'm not a girl," she yelled furious. What was wrong with them? They rode all this way for her, and here she was, and there they were, just smiling at her. "I'm the one you want." "He is the one we want." The officer jabbed his short sword toward the bull, who'd come forward to stand beside her, Praed's cheap steel in his hand. But it was a mistake to take his eyes off Yoren, even for an instant. Quick as that, the Black Brother's sword was pressed to the apple of the officer's throat.
"Neither's the one you get, lest you want me to see if your apple's ripe yet. I got me 10, 15 more brothers in that inn, if you still need convincing. I was you, and let loose of that gut-cutter, spread my cheeks over that fat little horse, and gallop on back to the city." He spat, and poked harder with the point of his sword. "Now!"
The officer's fingers uncurled. His sword fell in the dust.
"We'll just keep that," Yoren said. "Good steel's always needed on the wall."
"As you say, for now. Men?" The gold cloak sheathed and mounted up. "You'd best scamper up to that wall of yours in a hurry, old man. The next time I catch you, I believe I'll have your head to go with the bastard boys."
"Better men than you've tried."
Yoren slapped the rump of the officer's horse with the flat of his sword and sent him reeling off down the King's Road. His men followed. When they were out of sight, Hotpie began to whoop, but Yoren looked angrier than ever.
"Fool! You think he's done with this? Next time he won't prance up and hand me no damn ribbon. Get the rest out of them baths. We need to be moving. Ride all night. Maybe we can stay ahead of them for a bit."
He scooped up the short sword the officer had dropped.
"Who wants this?"
"Me!" Hotpie yelled.
"Don't be using it on Arya."
He handed the boy the sword hilt first and walked over to Arya, but it was the bull he spoke to.
"Queen wants you bad, boy."
Arya was lost. Why should she want him? The bull scowled at her. "Why should she want you? You're nothing but a little gutter rat." "Well, you're nothing but a bastard boy. Or maybe he was only pretending to be a bastard boy. What's your true name?"
Gendry, he said, like he wasn't quite sure.
"Don't see why no one wants neither of you," Yoren said. "But they can't have you regardless. You ride them 2 courses. First sight of a gold cloak, make for the wall like a dragon's on your tail. The rest of us don't mean spit to them."
"Except for you," Arya pointed out. "That man said he'd take your head too."
"Well, as to that," Yoren said, "if he can get it off my shoulders, he's welcome to it."
Davos. He watched the sail grow for a long time, trying to decide whether he would sooner live or die. Dying would be easier, he knew. All he had to do was crawl inside his cave and let the ship pass by, and death would find him. For days now the fever had been burning through him, turning his bowels to brown water and making him shiver in his restless sleep. Each morning found him weaker.
"It will not be much longer,"
he had taken to telling himself. If the fever did not kill him, thirst surely would. He had no fresh water here, but for the occasional rainfall that pooled in hollows on the rock. Only 3 days passed, or had it been four? On his rock it was hard to tell the days apart. His pools had been dry as old bone, and the sight of the bay, rippling green and grey all around him, had been almost more than he could bear. Once he began to drink seawater, the end would come swiftly, he knew. But all the same, he had almost taken that first swallow, so parched was his throat. A sudden squall had saved him. He had grown so feeble by then that it was all he could do to lie in the rain with his eyes closed and his mouth open and let the water splash down on his cracked lips and swollen tongue. But afterward, he felt a little stronger, and the island's pools and cracks and crevices once more had brimmed with life. But that had been 3 days ago, or maybe four, and most of the water was gone now. Some had evaporated, and he had sucked up the rest. By the morrow he would be tasting the mud again, and licking the damp coal stones at the bottom of the depressions. And if not thirst or fever, starvation would kill him. His island was no more than a barren spire, jutting up out of the immensity of Blackwater Bay. When the tide was low, he could sometimes find tiny crabs along the stony strand, where he had washed ashore after the battle. They nipped his fingers painfully before he smashed them apart on the rocks to suck the meat from their claws and the guts from their shells. But the strand vanished whenever the tide came rushing in, and Davis had to scramble up the rock to keep from being swept out into the bay once more. The point of the spire was 15 feet above the water at high tide, but when the bay grew rough, the spray went even higher, so there was no way to keep dry, even in his cave, which was really no more than a hollow in the rock beneath an overhang. Nothing grew on the rock but lichen, and even the seabirds shunned the place. Now and again some gulls would land atop the spire, and Davis would try to catch one, but they were too quick for him to get close. He took to flinging stones at them, but he was too weak to throw with much force, so even when his stones hit, the gulls would only scream at him in annoyance and then take to the air. There were other rocks visible from his refuge, distant stony spires taller than his own. The nearest stood a good 40 feet above the water, he guessed, though it was hard to be sure at this distance. A cloud of gulls swirled about it constantly, and often Davis thought of crossing over to raid their nests. But the water was cold here, the current strong and treacherous, and he knew he did not have the strength for such a swim. That would kill him as sure as drinking sea water. Autumn in the narrow sea could often be wet and rainy, he remembered from years past. The days were not bad, so long as the sun was shining, but the nights were growing colder, and sometimes the wind would come gusting across the bay, driving a line of white caps before it, and before long Davis would be soaked and shivering. Fever and chills assaulted him in turn, and of late he had developed a persistent racking cough. His cave was all the shelter he had, and that was little enough. Driftwood and bits of charred debris would wash up on the strand during low tide, but he had no way to strike a spark or start a fire. Once in desperation, he had tried rubbing two pieces of driftwood against each other, but the wood was rotted, and his efforts earned him only blisters. His clothes were sodden as well, and he had lost one of his boots somewhere in the bay before he washed up here. Thirst, hunger, exposure. They were his companions, with him every hour of every day, and in time he had come to think of them as his friends. Soon enough one or other of his friends would take pity on him and free him from this endless misery. Or perhaps he would simply walk into the water one day and strike out for the shore that he knew lay somewhere to the north, beyond his sight. It was too far to swim, as weak as he was, but that did not matter. Davis had always been a